From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Bienvenidos a Midnight Movie Cowboys. I'm Hunter Deucing, and with me is Mr. John Grace.
And no Stuart again.
No Stuart again, although I have an update right here from our Australia desk on his condition. Last we heard he had injured himself in the underground kangaroo boxing league on the fighting scene down there.
You've seen Matilda.
Yeah. Seen Kangaroo Jack.
Those rules are nothing to screw with.
And I heard that, you know, Stu's been on the Swole Patrol lately. He's been lifting a lot of weights, you know, drinking lots of beer, lifting weights, and eating
protein.
Or as
he calls it, beer.
Beer?
Yeah.
Not Foster's, though. Holy shit, don't make that joke.
But we've been fooled, apparently.
Yeah. He drinks VB, Victorian Bitter. But so he's been doing Swole Patrol, eating lots of creatine, protein, maybe some steroids, and he is joining up with the Thunder from Down Under to entertain ladies and maybe homosexuals, I'm not sure, with a male burlesque routine. So hitting the bachelorette party scene pretty hard. So that's what Stu's up to now.
Not watching Godzilla movies.
No. Just the gay one.
Yeah.
I posted the clip from Final Wars on his Facebook page of Godzilla and Zilla from the
Gino,
1998.
Godzilla in name only.
Yeah, Godzilla in name only fighting in Sydney. And I said he should watch that one because the Godzilla from the underage rape party fund that he likes. It destroys part of Sydney, and then Godzilla uses him to destroy the Sydney Opera House.
Wow.
And Stu said, well, I've seen the scene, so now I don't need to see the movie. So there's no, I can't win, John.
No, I wouldn't try to show anybody any of the Godzilla films from the last 20 years.
The best ones are from the 70s. I've been doing my favorite, or the 60s and 70s, I should say, and of course the original from 54. But I've been looking at my favorite Godzilla movies.
Mm-hmm.
I've been posting about them on Facebook. I mean, I love Final Wars. I think it's goofy and fun. But I was going over my favorites, and they're all from that original run from the Showa era.
Right, right. Yeah, for me, it's early 60s to about the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the ones that I frequently rewatch.
Yeah.
I always say, if you think that the first one that Ishiro Honda made that Criterion released on Blu-ray is the best, then you're boring. Because
I like that film a lot, but
it's a good film. It's a trendsetter.
I'd rather watch Ghidra, the three-headed monster.
Right. It's not. It's not fun to watch. Like the ones from the 60s are just brilliant.
The one from it's an art movie. Like the one from the 50s, it's like art house. Like it's like a Kurosawa monster movie.
Well, back then it was the big mainstream thriller, you know, for Japan. But the thing is, they've developed such a different tone and sense of filmmaking with the later films. Especially when they went and started working in Toho scope, it's just like you can't beat them. You cannot beat something that's in Toho scope in the 60s and in color with the Tsuburaya effects. And
like,
it's
Monster
just flawless.
Zero. Monster Zero rules. Like,
it's amazing. Like Nick Adams, like pulling up his pants every 5 minutes and then straightening out his tie.
I love Destroy All Monsters. That's one of my favorites, just for the final battle scene alone.
I'm not huge on that one, believe it or not.
I like that one a lot, and it's mostly because the final battle's so much fun.
Everybody likes the final battle. Everybody forgets about the excruciating wait for the final battle.
It is kind of excruciating, but I don't know. I like the kitschiness of it. I don't know.
There's I prefer Godzilla versus the Sea Monster, which I forget what they retitled that.
Ibera, Horror of the Deep or something.
Something like that. And I always saw it as Godzilla versus the Sea Monster, and probably my favorite was, other than Ghidra, like I like the original Godzilla versus Mothra, which when I was a kid was always called Godzilla versus the Thing.
Yeah, it was. That's what Corman retitled it, right?
I saw it. No, Arkoff.
Arkoff, okay.
Yeah, AIP. Corman had nothing to do with those.
Okay. And also one of my favorites is Hedorah.
Oh, of course. Yeah, that's actually the first one I saw. I was like four. Man, I saw that on TV.
It's so different. It's just such a crazy fucking movie. Like,
it's funny because that flopped in theaters, and AIP just threw it on television, and didn't acquire any more Godzillas after that. Then Cinema Shares started importing them, and it's funny because I think that was on TV by like 1974 or 73, like within just 2 years of being in theaters and flopping. And back then, that was pretty scarce for something to be on television.
And the guy who directed it, you know, that ruined his career.
He was banned from the Godzilla series.
Yeah, he worked on like movies with Kurosawa, and you know, had this promising career, and then he directed that movie. And Tomoyuki Tanaka was furious when he saw he had been
sick.
Yeah,
Tanaka said, "You've ruined Godzilla." He wanted to do a sequel that sounded cool, though. It was going to be Godzilla fighting Ghidorah in Africa.
He blackballed him. Like, he put him. Yeah. He basically relegated him to working on like low budget TV projects.
And you
stuff.
Know what the irony is? I think because that director got the rights to Godzilla to do an IMAX movie.
Yes,
that's what actually sparked the American production.
It is, and he's listed as a producer on this one.
Yeah, because he was trying to get the rights for a big IMAX film where he was going to have Godzilla fighting Ghidorah, I think, in IMAX, saving the environment. It was going to be like an hour-long film in 3D, but he couldn't get the funding because Toho wouldn't fund it, but they would license the thing. And somehow it got Hollywood interested, and then boom, you had Legendary Pictures got involved, and you got a new Godzilla film.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's one of those weird things where he tried to do basically okay, the series is dead in Japan, and contrary to what people believe, it's not as big in Japan as you would think.
No, Final Wars was a flop.
No, a huge bomb.
Yeah. It didn't.
I think
it
was the least successful one in the entire series history.
Yeah, it was not a successful film. But yeah, but we're not here to talk about Godzilla, John.
No.
We're here to talk about another monster.
A man of Godzilla-type girth and ego, but not Godzilla.
You already went there. I was going to say personality, but okay.
Yeah, the personality's there, too.
Yeah. We're talking about Mr. John Milius, and specifically the documentary called Milius that's about him.
Milius, which our guest Cameron on the Eirons episode had mentioned the movie to us, so then we went out of the way to see it.
Yeah, exactly.
And to follow up on it. So it's like, okay, this will make a good episode because it's a worthwhile documentary.
Well, because I loved John Milius when I was in college. Because mm-hmm. he was a right-wing gun fanatic in a...
And he had a beard. Hey, and I'm sensing a trend here.
And he had a beard. And he was like... He acted like Walter from Big Lebowski. Walter acted like him, I should say. And I thought he was awesome. And he was in a sea of liberals, like, from his generation of filmmakers. But, you know... When that generation of filmmakers came up in film classes, John Milius was, like, actively not spoken of.
Yeah.
It was not cool to like him, so I was kind of shocked when I saw this documentary that is, like, this loving look at John Milius come out. I was like, what? Wait, it's cool to like this guy now? What's going on?
Well, because it's the whole rebellious outlaw thing since... Spielberg is kind of seen as tired and churning out movies nobody cares about.
Well, George Lucas is just counting his money at this point.
Lucas is just counting his money, and, you know, who else is in that class?
Go ahead.
Oliver Stone, who's just seen as a whack job, so...
Who calls Milius a whack job.
Right, and, yeah, which I thought was insane. It's like, oh, okay, so being sophisticated and growing up is believing that the commies were right. Okay,
and loving, who's the dead dictator? Chavez.
Yeah, exactly. Going to give blowjobs to Chavez, like he's running some great society. You follow that Venezuelan feed that Defend Wall Street's been putting up there?
Yeah.
There's nothing to celebrate about Chavez.
No, nothing.
But, of course, you're not seeing it mentioned in our news because it would prove everybody wrong.
Yes. I have seen some stuff with Sean Penn talking about how good their current leader is, and Sean Penn with a crazy weird haircut.
Holding up signs going, Venezuela's got a great leader.
Yeah, he's been ball washing their current leader, which
of course is hilarious. Because he's a worthless moron.
Because he's insane. Like all.
He's actually dumber than Spicoli was in the film.
Oh, totally.
At least Spicoli used his money to hire Van Halen to play his birthday party.
Exactly. Spicoli knew how to party, man.
Exactly.
Lest we forget, Oliver Stone is also a big fan of Castro. So.
Right.
He did a loving documentaries about him too. But so I was like, but even Oliver Stone goes, it may seem insane that I'm saying that.
Yeah.
Even it kind of acknowledges it, but yeah, but I do miss the days where Oliver Stone just made crazy movies. Now
right.
He makes like really boring political movies.
He makes like what used to be a TV movie of the week.
His George Bush movie certainly felt like that.
I haven't seen it. I actually got a copy of it, and I have not watched it yet. I found it for like a buck at a store going out of business, so I just picked it up. I said, okay, I can watch it once and donate it or something.
You know, Richard Dreyfuss is Dick Cheney. I wouldn't be shocked if Richard Dreyfuss went up to Oliver Stone and went, you know, what I think this character needs is a good set of horns to glue on. Perhaps I could have a CGI forked tongue and maybe cat's eye contact
Which,
lenses.
Now there's a clip going around of from Mike Huckabee's show of Richard Dreyfuss talking about the Constitution and how nobody understands it.
What?
And sound, yeah, I swear. It's like he's talking about how everybody's ignorant of the Constitution and it makes him sick.
Okay.
and he's being all nice to Huckabee and everything. It's
what?
Weird. Yes! Yes! Maybe,
has
it.
He reached this phase where his bleeding heart gets old and swings to the right?
I think he's an old school liberal, and maybe he's a little tired of the left.
The
type,
direction,
you know,
it's gone.
Right, the left wing and liberals are actually two different things. And I believe that he's an old school. He used to be Harlan Ellison's roommate, like in the late 50s
no
or something.
Shit. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, yeah. That was his roommate at one
Richard
point.
Richard Dreyfuss, who died a very violent death in a John Milius movie.
And there was some rumor going around that Dreyfuss, in The Goodbye Girl, he's actually doing, he was somewhat inspired by Harlan Ellison in his performance.
Oh, really? That's funny.
Yeah, which wouldn't surprise me. But, yeah, you've got Oliver Stone talking, and they all act like John was the guy they were scared of, and secretly admiring in that class at USC.
They talked about him like he was the most promising member of that class, and I had never heard that before.
Yeah, like, I hadn't heard that either.
I'd always seen him discussed as a footnote. Like, right. Oh, also John Milius was in this group. He, you know, worked on the movies with them, and he did the Marcello I'm So Bored film.
Right.
Which, I mean, did get mentioned in some papers I read, but mm-hmm. I never saw him discussed as, like, in a historical context, as a serious contender in that school.
No, he was never considered, he was never taken seriously by critics.
No, well, Pauline Kael, you know?
Yeah. Well, she, I think she liked The Wind and the Lion, and she liked, I think she liked Big Wednesday quite a bit.
She was marveling at all the muscle-bound men, you know.
But for once in her life.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's because none of them were Clint Eastwood.
Because they didn't look like Clint Eastwood or Steve McQueen, and she hated both of them, so.
Yeah, he even brings up Pauline Kael. They all warned, she warned us he was a fascist. But I was kind of shocked at how many people they got in this movie. They got Schwarzenegger,
yeah.
They got Eastwood, they got Michael Mann, they got Spielberg, Lucas, Scorsese. Mm-hmm. They got Charlie Sheen.
Yeah, it's kind of it was. Well, I mean, all of them worked with him in some capacity or mm-hmm. another.
Yeah,
and you know, like Eastwood, basically Milius is probably responsible for a lot of the memorable things, Dirty Harry and Magnum Force.
Yep,
and like. Eastwood, I think, considered Milius one of his proteges, sort of like he was like, give the young writer a shot.
Well,
you know, he was real big on that.
Eastwood was originally supposed to play Jeremiah Johnson.
Yeah, that would have been probably a more interesting film
with
if he shot 100%
directing.
Of Milius's. Right, and imagine that with Milius's script, which he says they only shot 65% of it in this documentary about
right.
of the Redford version. You know, because he had a lot of liver eating, which was a true part of that character.
It was. That's one thing that annoyed me was they have Sidney Pollack talking about the Milius script, saying, oh, it was this piece of violence, and he's going around, he's carving out the livers, and he's eating livers. And, you know, and it's supposed to be like, oh, wow, look at how crazy John Milius is. But no, his name, Jeremiah Johnson, was called Liver Eater Johnson.
Yes, that was the reality of it.
Because he ate their livers because the crows believed that that was a part of the afterlife.
That reminds me of the German kickboxing woman who directed Punisher Warzone. She said she could not stand it how critics would say, "How can a, it's sad that a woman came up with all this violence." She goes, "I didn't come up with any of this. It's all in the comic book.
Yeah.
I just brought the comic book to life."
It's
That's all
like
I was
doing. It's not like she had these violent fantasies in her head and she was like, "I have to get these out."
Yeah,
I know.
Milius was just bringing the real history of that character to the movie.
But the way it's presented in the documentary is, "Oh, John Milius is nuts." You know?
Right.
He's too violent, you know.
Right, right. And George Hamilton, when he hired Milius to do the Evel Knievel script, I thought that was pretty fun. But I don't find it any more unique that, oh, Milius spent the money on guns and whores and parties at his, you know, in use of a mansion. Is that any different from any other screenwriter back then? You
that
know?
Was par for the course.
Yeah, that's kind of like the thing. Is, you know, it was sleazy Hollywood back
then. Yeah, I mean, you give a young, hormone-filled 20-something...
Yeah.
A blank check in, like, cars and chicks.
Right.
Guess what they're going to do?
You know? Yeah, this guy's not hiding what he is. He's, like deer hunting on the weekends and driving around Hollywood in a truck and hunting dogs and stuff. So he's, like, yeah, he's a frustrated. He was a military washout in terms of he couldn't pass a physical because he had asthma. So he was a wannabe military guy.
Yeah.
And he kind of channeled all that frustration, I think, into his screenwriting.
Well, and that's,
and of course,
what,
he's real knowledgeable about history because he was from that generation that admired cowboys and the Old West and real historical figures like Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, that's what a common thread in his movies like Wind and the Lion, like Judge Roy Bean, Jeremiah Johnson. You see this admiration for the frontiersman,
yeah,
the independent man. Like, he describes himself as a Zen anarchist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the he's talking in sense of the absence of government, the man who is self-sufficient, who lives off the land. Like, you know, he always spoke in terms of, like, government is something that human beings shouldn't even have, you know? Which I don't know about that, but
he's from I believe he's from Missouri, right? And so he was like, he's from that old school mentality of, you know, they're descended from frontier stock.
Well, and you know what's funny is I was thinking about that this weekend, John, because, you know, something you've often talked about is the, you know, way men aren't really men anymore. And
yeah, and I'm certainly not the only person saying that stuff these days.
No.
You go to any website and I swear you see some essay about men are sissies now.
Yeah, exactly. Like, but I went to the Pacific War Museum in Fredericksburg.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the boyhood home of Chester Nimitz, who was one of the commanders of the Pacific War,
right,
in the U.S. Army. And it talked about his upbringing, and, you know, he was born in the late 1800s, worked at a hotel, like his family's hotel, the Nimitz Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was a kind of a stop out there. And it was hard work, and he kind of descended from frontiersmen because Fredericksburg was a frontier town. And it seemed like that was something that carried over into the army. And you had these people who remember what it was like to be on the frontier. Like, and I was thinking about this while watching Jeremiah Johnson.
Yeah.
People who remember what it was like to have it hard. And then, of course, you have the Great Depression.
Right.
And so we've had these hard times. And now we have these generations of people who don't remember any of that. They just remember all they've had is urbanization, MTV. You know, life has been pretty easy.
The worst part of their childhood was they quit making Quisp cereal.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Their parents who, you know, suffered through the Depression and World War II and all that stuff, they, you know, built a good life out for them. And so we mm-hmm. have several generations where it's just kind of degenerated to where, you know, nobody knew what it was like to suffer.
No.
And so we've always had our food prepared for us. We never had to go out and kill our food. We've never had to go out and, you know, make fire and build a hut and all that shit.
Well, it reminds me of G. Gordon Liddy's book, Will, his autobiography, which I read and I recommend highly recommend to anybody. You can find it at a library sale near you for about 25 cents. But he said when he was in the FBI, and I believe it was like the 50s, I might be wrong on that, but he said that the shooting instructors they had who trained them were like the surviving Old West gunfighters.
Really?
The FBI found them and used them to teach FBI men how to handle a gun battle.
The,
and would teach them stuff like, Yeah, try to shoot one hand and stand sideways so you're less of a target, and like all these weird tips because these guys had supposedly been in these gun battles and, you know, do what worked in the Old West would work for the G-men. So
wow,
yeah,
that's insane.
Yeah, honestly, if you want some follow up to some John Milius type kicks, read G. Gordon Liddy's Will. I can't recommend it.
That sounds
great.
You know,
more. It made it to a fun TV movie with Robert Conrad as G. Gordon Liddy in like 1980.
So, as we all know, John Milius also directed Conan the Barbarian. And this is one thing you and I have talked about a lot. I don't know how much we've talked about it on the show, but...
I can't recall if we mentioned it on the show.
I don't know if we have or not. But, you know, John and I are both kind of the same opinion. Well, I think I like the movie in general more than you do.
You probably do.
As far as...
put it this way, Hunter, if you like it, you already like it more than
okay, there you go. See, I do enjoy it as a movie, but as a Robert E. Howard adaptation, it's a complete failure.
Yeah, I don't even like it as a movie. I rewatched it a few weeks ago, and I didn't think it was very good back then. It's aged worse, in my opinion, than anything else I can think of.
Well, and the problem with it is that Schwarzenegger's Conan is such a passive, like, kind of, you know...
He's an oaf.
Kind of crybaby. You know?
He just gets he's a crybaby and he's an oaf and he gets a hell beat out of him half the movie. He's not even proactive.
No.
It's ridiculous.
But this movie, like, you know, there is this idea that Conan the Barbarian was like the launching pad for Schwarzenegger. And it was a serious role for him. But it, you know, Schwarzenegger didn't become Schwarzenegger till like the Terminator, you know?
Yeah, the Terminator is what established Schwarzenegger as a draw. Conan the Barbarian was not a hit, and I've always emphasized this, was not a hit back in the day. It was a box office disappointment. And
it was supposed to be the R-rated Star Wars, is what it was
right,
supposed to be.
Right, and everybody's like, oh man, you're wrong, man, it was a worldwide hit. Man. It's like, no, it didn't. It grossed about $39 million, which was decent for the time, but not great. And a movie that made about $500,000 less was The Sword and the Sorcerer. The Albert Pune movie made about the same amount of money. Actually made more money because it didn't cost nearly as much.
And also, I mean, I think people from that era think it was a hit because they saw it on HBO a lot or something.
Right. It was on HBO a lot because it was a sale to cable that was probably going to make some of its money back. But if you think it was a hit, ask yourself, like, Conan the Destroyer was made with a PG-13, or actually a PG rating. They didn't have a PG-13.
Exactly. Like, they fired Milius, and they got Richard Fleischer to come on board.
Milius was fired. Fleischer was brought aboard, and they wanted something more enjoyable for kids, and they wanted to pump up the fantasy element more, which they thought Milius really slacked on. And, like, the president of Universal didn't like Conan the Barbarian. He thought he wanted Milius to cut more of the gore out. He thought it was too violent. They were supposed to put it out at Christmas. Mm. They did not. They delayed it till summer. I remember as a kid seeing trailers for Conan the Barbarian forever before it finally came out. We were just never clear when it was going to be released because they just ran the trailers forever. And when it finally opened, boy, me and my dad were so disappointed. That
yeah, because your dad was a big Robert E. Howard fan.
He was read all the books and even had read some of the comic books, I think were the last things he read in comics, you know, when he was in college. And he just loved the character and loved the original stories that Howard did. And he turned to me halfway through the movie. He's like, this ain't nothing like the books. You know, because it's boring. It's just plots. Like, you really feel that length and pace in the theater. It's just like, ugh. And as a kid, I wanted some action, and we're not getting it.
Yeah.
You know, like, everybody's like, it was innovative. No, that summer the Road Warrior came out.
No.
That blew everybody away.
That was innovative, the Road Warrior.
The Road Warrior blew everybody away. That was an action movie everybody was talking about. Nobody cared about Conan. Conan was gone, like, after a few weeks. Rocky III opened. It was completely forgotten.
Yeah.
It's like, believe me, it was not a hit.
Everybody who looks back on it fondly saw it on HBO. That's because I'm convinced. Because everybody I've talked to talks about watching it on TV.
Right, and Milius just didn't... I don't even know if Milius read any Howard. I think he took the Oliver Stone script, which was a bit more faithful to the Howard stories, but still crazy in its own way, but would have been more fun if that was filmed instead of Milius' version. He took it and kind of turned it into his own obsession with Nietzschean and Mongols. He's always wanted to make a Genghis Khan movie. Conan is speaking dialogue said to be spoken by Genghis Khan. If you read Harold Lamb's Genghis Khan book, it's all there. You know, crush your enemies, lamentation of the women. yeah, the Khan, you know, Genghis Khan said that stuff. So it's, this is my problem with the documentary. They act like Conan was this huge hit. It was not. it's this kind of revisionism of what really happened back then. But if you go back and look to Box Office Mojo and look at the numbers, you'll see it just didn't do that great.
Well, because in the documentary, they act like his career should have been huge because he had, you know, Conan, and then he had Red Dawn.
He had directed a flop, and Red Dawn was not a big hit either. You know what opened the same weekend as Red Dawn? Purple Rain. Guess what everybody was going to see the rest of, for the next few months? Then the Terminator opened. Nobody cared about Red Dawn after about a week. Red Dawn's another one, big because of HBO.
Yeah. I mean,
so they have this revisionist history. Like, he was making these box office hits. They weren't that big. In many ways, they were just as big flops as Big Wednesday.
Yeah, Big Wednesday was the one he traded points with Spielberg and Lucas on over Close Encounters and Star Wars.
Yeah.
Because that was always an infamous story that they traded points over that. Lucas lost out big time.
Oh, yeah. And Big Wednesday is a decent film. Like, I've seen it, and it's actually worth watching.
That is one of the only ones he's directed I haven't seen.
Really, it's worth a look. And Dillinger, they talk about Dillinger and Spielberg.
Let's start off with that. Let's go ahead and talk about Dillinger, because I really like that movie.
Yeah, that's a fun movie, and Spielberg says he rates it as high as Bonnie and Clyde. I actually rate it over Bonnie
and Clyde.
I think
it's way better than Bonnie and Clyde, because
Bonnie and Clyde is super overrated.
Bonnie and Clyde's a left-wing fantasy.
It is, and they look like models, and my grandfather always hated that.
Oh, if you look at the pictures of them, they're fuck ugly.
Yeah.
I mean, I even like that in the movie, Dillinger slags off Bonnie and Clyde. He goes, those crazy mad dogs give us a bad name.
Yeah. That's a cool thing. Well, it's Warren Oates. Just giving a great performance.
Well, Warren Oates, you got Harry Dean Stanton. You got Richard Dreyfuss as Babyface Nelson.
King Pistol Whipped.
Oh, he just, that one of my favorite bits is where Dillinger just beats the shit out of him. You know who I am? I'm John Dillinger. But Warren Oates just brings that charm to it. It's way better than Public Enemies, tell you what.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I haven't seen Public Enemies.
Public Enemies has some good stuff about it. It's a flawed movie, but the shootouts are pretty killer, but it's not nearly as good as this.
Right. Well, there's also The Wind and the Lion, which is probably Millis's all-around best movie.
I agree with that.
What's his name? The actor playing Teddy Roosevelt.
Brian Keith.
Yeah, the late Brian Keith is Teddy Roosevelt. I thought he's really good. And Connery's just chewing the scenery is the Rizzoli. And there's endless stunts of a guy falling off the horse. And that's Terry Leonard, I think, did all those stunts, and he was a buddy of Milius's, and that was his specialty. So every time somebody falls off a horse in that movie and in Conan the Barbarian, it's like Terry Leonard.
And I thought Wind
Same
and the
guy
Lion
guy every time.
I thought Wind and the Lion did a better job of homaging Milius's love of samurai movies than Conan did.
Yes, like, it did.
The bit where the Raisuli saves the woman and her kids from that horde, he fights them on the shores. I was like, that's straight out of like a Kurosawa movie.
Right. Sweet. That was way more fun, I thought. Yeah. In the documentary, Milius talks about his life was changed when he attended like a Kurosawa festival at a local theater. Mm-hmm. Which, to imagine a theater having a Kurosawa festival these days, it's tough. Even the Alamo Draft House won't do something that daring.
They wouldn't have a whole festival. They might show a movie. But
right, it was back then. There was, I'm not sure what the market was like back then with showing foreign films, but
who
knows?
In California too, which might have been a little more,
open to that stuff.
Yeah.
Well, it's like I had an uncle who was he worked in Hawaii like in the early '60s, I believe, and he was a big fan of Ingmar Bergman movies.
Mm.
And I guess he saw them in a theater in Hawaii. I couldn't figure out where he saw them or how he got into them, because he wasn't somebody you would expect to see at a, an art house theater. He's the type of guy who was following Mississippi State SEC games every weekend. But he was asking me one time if I could get him dubs of some Ingmar Bergman movies, which I could. So he wanted to see them.
You know, some of Bergman's older stuff, though, it's a little more accessible. It's not as like kind of hand-wringy drama stuff,
Right. Well, I think his later stuff was actually produced for television and released
in
theaters.
The last film he did in theaters was Fanny and Alexander, I think.
Yeah, and that was like a TV miniseries.
Yeah, there was a theatrical version and a TV miniseries version that was longer.
Jeez, I couldn't sit through it.
No, I couldn't either. I love stuff like Seven Seal. I lean more
towards Kurosawa than that stuff.
Oh, sure, but I love Seven Seal. I love Persona. Some of his movies are really great. But there was like a period where his movies did have sort of a, I guess, a genre appeal. maybe, but not so much. His later films were very dramatic, a lot,
right?
You know, like, you know, scenes from a marriage, stuff like that.
He wasn't a Liu Cheliang, homie.
No way, son. But like, one thing about Wind in the Lion I love is seeing Teddy Roosevelt discuss foreign policy while boxing.
Yeah, well, that's the way he really was.
I know, but
he's either boxing or he's
could
in
you imagine Barack Obama doing
on the
that?
Lawn?
You know, what I mean?
These days our presidents are like riding bicycles with helmets.
They're playing golf.
Yeah, playing golf and eating ice cream. And back then, Teddy Roosevelt was like boxing and shooting and doing
fighting
judo
bears.
On the lawn. Yeah.
That's one of
he's
the
like
best.
Endorsing a self defense book. And
it's one of the best is he's talking about he helped kill the bear and talks about the spirit of the bear and how it's similar to that of the American.
It's a great, great moment there.
But like you said, like it's Milius's most complete movie. I think I agree with that. It's really well directed. It's well written. It feels like his complete vision right there. That's
right.
You know, well done. And it's not, you know, at the detriment of something else the way Conan is or something like that.
Or Red Dawn, which has a great opening 10 minutes. And then,
oh, by the way, going back to Dillinger.
Yeah.
It also features Ben Johnson as Melvin Purvis, who
yes.
we discussed last week. And I was watching the film again and in credits, guess who was a set decorator? Charles Pierce, baby.
Was he?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was
Whoa.
In the credits.
I was not aware of that.
Because he did stuff for AIP. So.
Right, right.
Isn't that crazy?
Wow.
I saw that. This is Charles Pierce, set decorator. And I went, oh my gosh.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Or was it, wasn't there another Charles Pierce? Who was
No, I think it was that Charles Pierce. Cause
okay.
I can double check.
Because I know there's a Charles Pierce who worked as an actor for AIP.
No, this was a set decorator.
Okay.
Yeah,
it might have been. If they filmed
Charles Pierce's, that was his specialty was set decoration for a while.
Okay. Huh.
Yeah, it's right here. I just looked it up. Set decorator, Dillinger.
Interesting.
Yeah, this was after Legend of Boggy Creek, too.
Sadly, not covered in the documentary.
No, not at all. A lot of his movies are just kind of barely mentioned. Like, you know, they don't talk at all about...
Because they weren't successful.
Yeah, like Flight of the Intruder. Nobody remembers that.
I saw that in theater. That was horrible. It's
really?
Like, okay, he created... Oh, it's terrible. It's boring as hell.
I've never seen it. That's one
Farewell to the King, the Nick Nolte in the Pacific movie, where he's like a chief of the... Milius wrote Apocalypse Now.
He
apparently liked to use that theme of a civilized man who's like a super soldier going back and lording over natives and reverting to native ways.
It's the same kind of archetype from like Judge Roy Bean, Jeremiah Johnson.
Right. And Farewell to the King is like very tedious to get through. It was barely released. I think it was made for Orion at the time and they were going bankrupt. So it wasn't going to be a commercial
success. Didn't it
success
get like cut to shit or something? I can't remember. But
may have.
I don't remember
much about it. But the thing is, it wouldn't have made a difference. It wasn't going to be a hit. There was just no way that film... Milius did not make... This is the problem I have with the documentary. He did not make commercial movies. The stuff was not going to be huge.
Mm-mm.
It's like, if you make these movies that... He had a problem with pacing, and they don't talk... Of course, they don't say anything critical about his work, but he had a real issue with
pacing.
The only
critical thing is that it's right-wing, you know?
Right. Oh, you know, because he's a conservative or whatever he claims he is... You know, that's the big reason that he's been blackballed. No, his movies lost money. That's why he was blackballed.
Well, they're
like
absolutely right.
Successful.
I mean, it's Hollywood's a banking entity, like an Eastwood. Although I had to laugh that Schwarzenegger was like, I've been out there as a Republican. Dude, Schwarzenegger, you are not a conservative.
No, he's not.
He may be identify as a Republican, but he's about as Republican as Barack Obama, you know?
He's a Republican, but he's not a conservative. There is
no exactly. That's
there's a huge difference.
Like John McCain's a Republican, but he's not a conservative.
Yeah.
But like Clint Eastwood said, you know, they don't care if you're Lenin, you know. I mean,
right.
if you put out, you know, good money making stuff. Now I have noticed that Hollywood is more than willing to allow a left wing flop to go unnoticed for an artist, but.
Oh yeah, I mean they're big on that. But look at Spike Lee, who's like tries to crowdsource his movies now.
Mm.
He's like he's doing the crowdfunding thing. And it's he can't get it done because he makes too many bombs.
It's
because
he's had way too many flops. I mean, I think Hollywood will let a rendition like Gavin Hood's CIA is Evil movie the CIA's racist, I should say, Islamophobic, right. whatever, movie, they kind of let that, they gave him Wolverine after that.
Right, right. Well, like, Soderbergh, I think, has made too many flops, and I think that's why he's really, quote-unquote, retiring from film, is because they don't want to finance his stuff anymore. He doesn't make money.
No, yeah, he hasn't had a hit since... Magic Mike, did that do well? I don't remember.
That did pretty well, but I think, I don't know if that actually negated his other flops.
No, I don't think it did. I mean,
I don't know if it made up for it or whatever, but I mean,
Haywire didn't do well, did it?
No, it didn't. And in retrospect, it probably didn't deserve to. I mean, his stuff doesn't cost a lot, but I don't think it makes very much. And it's just kind of like they get tired of that. They like, so you have to go seek out your financing.
Oh, the porn audience went out in droves to see Girlfriend Experience, John.
Oh, I forgot that was released. but with Milius, like, he's claiming it's his politics. I don't think it's his politics. Here's the thing. He's a super respected rewriter, script doctor.
Well,
and
something
he did, his script doctoring is fantastic. Dirty Harry, Jaws, Hunt for Red October, which I didn't even know he wrote.
I didn't know that either.
That was a stunner. It's like, well, those are the only watchable things on video for that movie. Well,
something that they just kind of glossed over, where I was kind of like, wait, what? Is they said Sean Connery has John rewrite all of his roles, and I was thinking, wait, so Sean Connery, if he does a movie, John Milius has to come in and punch up his dialogue, like that's part of the deal.
Yeah.
Wow, because they just kind of glossed over that and then talked about Hunt for Red October.
Well, I had always heard that Milius secretly rewrote Lone Wolf McQuaid.
Well, he was credited as spiritual advisor on Lone Wolf.
Yeah, and I think he actually did a serious overhaul of the script.
That wouldn't surprise me. Lone Wolf,
which strangely, that one has better dialogue and better action construction than any of Norris's other movies.
Oh, it's probably Chuck's best movie.
Easily, I think even Norris would say it's his best movie.
Yeah, I mean it's got David.
That
Carradine.
One's due for a rewatch. Maybe that should be a future show.
Oh wait, definitely.
We might actually be able to bring Stu back on for that.
My favorite is Chuck dousing himself in beer. What is buried?
We were kids. We love that scene.
He's biz trucks buried.
I saw it opening night in the theater, and all the rednecks in the crowd were just rooting like crazy when that scene.
Oh, just he's like he's in a ditch, and he just like pours beer all over himself, and then just like guns the engine, and boom, he's out.
Oh, it's awesome.
And it has like that Ennio Morricone knockoff score.
Yeah, and Robert Belcher's like, shit, Ranger. It's like,
this is two shows in a row we brought up Lone Wolf McQuaid.
Is it? I don't remember.
Last time we brought it up because of Lone Wolf Gonzalez or whatever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right.
Not that our audience cares, but anyway.
Or, as some people say, David Carradine's the best line. Boys are just having a little fun, Ranger.
Yeah.
But, and then Darcel, you want to join in on the fun?
But so, and what do you think of Red Dawn?
Has a great first 15 minutes with the invasion, and then the rest of the movie's tedious. I saw it opening night with the line for Purple Rain being 10 times longer.
Yeah.
With black people back then, the punk funk thing was still around, extended off of Rick James. So I saw black people wearing stuff. They weren't the breakdancing black people. They weren't the Michael Jackson crowd. It was a totally different crowd. Like, it was like what would be called goth years later. Like, the Prince fans were totally different cats. And so I saw a whole line of them going to see Purple Rain, which is the movie everybody still talks about today. And we go see Red Dawn, and I remember my stepdad didn't care much for it.
Yeah.
Like, we all thought the opening 15 minutes was exciting, and then the rest of it is just kind of silly.
There's a lot of hiding in the hills.
Then it turns into, like, this Tolstoy thing with, like, William Smith speaking Russian and Ron O'Neill, and just it's really strange.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not the big action movie everybody thinks it is. They just saw it on HBO and got to go play outside after the opening 20 minutes.
Yeah, and like they talk about it as it was like one of the first PG-13 movies, and they're like, oh, it's such a
It was the first. I can tell you right now, it was the very first PG-13 film.
Yes.
Because when we saw the rating when they advertised on MTV, I was like, what is a PG-13?
Yeah.
And apparently, because Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom had freaked everybody out, they had to have the PG-13.
Well,
so it's
like Spielberg kept getting like PG ratings for movies that were too intense. Like Poltergeist was a PG. Jesus.
Yes.
Like,
Guy rips his face off, man.
Yeah, that movie's hideous. Like, Spielberg just had this, like, giant dick where he could just, like, no, it's a PG.
Raiders, when the Nazis melted in Raiders, I was stunned when I was like, yeah. Man, I was like 9 or 8, and I was freaking out. I was like, whoa, what? So, I'd never seen anything like that in a theater.
So I want to go over a couple of his written movies. Life and Times of Judge Roy Bean. What do you make of that one?
I saw it like 13 years ago. I rented the video, and it seems like I liked it. Milius didn't seem high on it.
No,
like,
he didn't.
The movement was wrong, and
I thought the movie was freaking hilarious. I loved
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I need to see it again. So if I that's one, like, if I see it in Big Lots,
Paul Newman getting shit-faced with a bear. And, like, yelling at the bear, and, like, it's him there with a real bear, like, screaming in a bear's face.
And, you know, the funny thing is, at the time, I didn't think it was that ridiculous, because I was watching a lot of the Terrence Hill, Bud Spencer Western.
Yeah, that's
part seriously, of this is around the time I was going to video stores when VHS was dying out, and DVDs were slowly making their way into video stores, like, 2001, I think. Uh-huh. And you could go rent videotapes for like 50 cents each on Tuesday nights. And I would rent a bunch of Terrence Hill movies and Bud Spencer films. And I saw Life and Times of Judge Roy Bean. I rented that in the big, ugly Warner Brothers video box and watched that. But it didn't seem so ridiculous at the time because watching Trinity Is Still My Name. So
yeah, I think I saw that one before I saw the Trinity films and all that good stuff. Before I even saw My Name Is Nobody. But,
right.
But I just was sitting there like my jaw on the floor like, just at some of the antics in that movie. And I know John Milius wasn't thrilled. I mean, apparently he wasn't that angry at John Huston because he put him in Wind and the Lion. But
right.
The story he tells in the documentary is that Lee Marvin was supposed to do it, and then he got drunk and passed out, and Paul Newman
picked up the script and then bought the rights to it while Lee Marvin was drunk and asleep.
Something like that. Another one he wrote was Magnum Force with Michael Cimino.
Right, which I'm now finding out was apparently worked off of a treatment Terrence Malick did for Dirty Harry.
Really?
Yes, where Scorpio was going to be killing rich people who got away with crimes. Because it's a Terrence Malick, like, left-wing viewpoint of things.
Terrence Malick's movies don't seem that political to me, though.
No, they're not really. But I guess when back then he was putting that stuff into the scripts he was submitting. Because he was writing an action film, so he put that in. They didn't like it for the original Dirty Harry script, so they, but they kind of reworked the idea in Magnum Force with Milius and Cimino do it. And you know, it's funny mentioning Cimino's name. Cimino was such a big deal after The Deer Hunter.
Yeah, he was.
And then he was nothing by 1986
or so. Heaven's Gate. It was this
right.
Massive
just
plot.
Destroyed him, and it's like, but they talked about Cimino like he was the future and everything, and it's like it's kind of trippy thinking about that.
Well, he did that Clint Eastwood flick, Thunderbolt and Lightfoot,
which is really good.
Yeah, it is. But and then he did Deer Hunter, which have you seen Heaven's Gate?
I have not seen the whole film in years.
The Criterion Blu-ray of it is it's like because I used to have the DVD of it, and the DVD was unwatchable. The transfer was so bad.
It was non-anamorphic.
No, it wasn't. And
a friend of mine complains about that. Like,
and Criterion just totally cleaned it up, and it looks amazing.
Yeah, it's probably one that I might subscribe to Hulu soon. Like, I'll give up Warner Archives for Hulu, and I think they have all the Criterion stuff for streaming, including stuff Criterion hasn't even released, like Black Lizard, that I would mind catching up with.
They had all the Zatoichi stuff on there last time I checked.
So it's the Criterion transfers of the Zatoichi movies.
Yes.
Because apparently they did new cleanup transfers for those Blu-rays, so
they're
supposed
amazing.
To look great. And, you know, the thing is that set goes on sale, but it's always like, you know, a sale price is $110. I have already spent probably nearly that much collecting the old DVDs when they were out of print.
I've got to tell you, they look great on Blu-ray, though. Holy shit.
But son of a bitch, I hate spending that much money on movies I already own.
Indeed, double dipping. And plus, like, if you sold those DVDs, you'd probably get like $5 for them, you know?
barely, because you know what? After that was released, a bunch of them showed up in the used DVD shops.
Oh, of course.
People traded them in because they got their Blu-rays.
Oh, every time the Criterion Collection shelf at Half Price Books is the Blu-ray of this movie came out shelf.
Exactly. Like, a ton of them showed up at the Second Spin, which is a FYE branch out here in Denver. And it was ridiculous. And I always wondered if Milius was inspired by things other than Kurosawa.
Yeah.
Since Conan has, like, stuff swiped from Kwaidan.
Yes, it does. I think, actually, he has said that was inspired by Kwaidan.
Right, and you know, I wonder if how much Akamoto he saw, because I actually think Sword of Doom is better than most Kurosawa films.
Sword of Doom is bloody great.
The greatest movie of all time.
It's one of them. That movie, I couldn't get my jaw off the floor how fucking violent it is.
Yeah, it's Sword of Doom is fantastic, and I just found the used Criterion for like $10.
Yeah,
like because it's not on Blu-ray. I don't think they have enough interest to put it out on Blu-ray.
No, it's the DVD release is bare bones as it is.
Right, and I mean on Blu-ray, it's going to have that black and white grain that they always get off the negatives. So probably better just to go DVD with that.
Yeah,
but with Milius' stuff, like what you, I mean, I know his TV work in the '90s is probably well loved. Like you'd tell me Rough Riders, which I haven't seen.
Rough Riders is great. I think that's one of his best, the best things he's done. I haven't seen it in years, so.
You know, and that's Teddy Roosevelt again. He's doing.
Yeah, it's Teddy again, and it's got Tom Berenger, it's got Sam Neill, it's got Gary Busey.
Right. can't really miss with that. And they do mention that, as Cameron had brought up, and I had known about, was that he created the format of the Ultimate Fighting Championship.
Yes, he did. The octagon.
Because he was a Gracie Jiu-Jitsu student. He was one of the early Hollywood celebrity students.
It's kind of funny how like. Many things he's been involved in. Like, he wrote some of the, I don't know if it was Call of Duty or Medal of Honor, but he wrote some of those games.
Yeah.
I think he wrote, like, Call of Duty World at War or something. Like,
well, the oddest thing was he's got that Genghis Khan script that he's been wanting to film for the longest time. Mm-hmm. And they interview Andre Morgan, and Morgan's talking about how they're still pushing as a property. And it's funny, because Andre Morgan got his start at Golden Harvest.
Oh, really?
In the early 70s. If you see the Angela Mao Ying movie, When Taekwondo Strikes, Andre Morgan plays a priest. And he gets slapped around by the Japanese villains.
I noticed he had a little Buddha on his desk.
Right. Yeah, he was a Golden Harvest guy for years. When Golden Harvest went out of business, he was full-time. I mean, he helped produce the Cannonball Run and basically got production set up in Hollywood and produced the Martial Law TV show. And I guess for some reason he's handling Milius's Genghis Khan script.
Yeah, didn't they work on Farewell to the King together or something?
Probably did, because Morgan was pretty much in Hollywood by then.
Like he said that they had a major disagreement about that movie or something.
Oh, but, they probably did. But if you watch that movie, it's very, I don't know if producer or director would be right about that film.
And have you seen, it's a troubled film, to be sure.
Yeah.
And have you seen Rome, the TV series?
I've seen Rome, the TV show. I watched, I think, the first season and maybe half of the second. And I liked it at first, and I got a little tired of it. Like, I'm not really a TV guy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've still got two episodes of Breaking Bad to watch.
Oh, that's right.
And then I'm done with the series. But I don't do these blitzes because I get tired of TV shows.
Well, and it's because their TV's so soap opera-y now. It's like, you have to keep up with it.
The story goes on and on, and something that you could resolve in a movie in 2 hours takes like 8 episodes to get over a plot line.
It's funny. I'm watching Breaking Bad with my dad, and sometimes we'll watch an episode. My dad goes, "Yeah, nothing really happened in that one."
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, okay, it's good. The acting is terrific. The filmmaking is better for television than it's probably ever been. But there's how many times can you get away with episodes where nothing really happens?
Well, it's like the Fly episode in season 3 of Breaking Bad. My dad was pissed.
I know people who were pissed off at that. And they quit watching the show.
My dad was like, "Nothing happened in that episode." But I don't. I started watching Rome recently, and I'm enjoying it so far.
It's a good show. It's I'm not a TV person. And it's funny that
apparently
a lot of the cast made it into John Carter. They were hired because they were on Rome.
Oh, and some of them made it into Game of Thrones too. Like,
yeah, it's true. Which I've never seen.
Ciaran Hinds, who played Caesar, plays one of the villains in season 3 of that show, and the guy who played Brutus plays a major character in season 3 too. But. But I had heard that there was ambitions for Rome to go all the way to like the birth of Christ and Jesus and all that stuff. It was supposed to they had like a trajectory for it to cover all these major events in Roman history.
That would have just been too expensive, and
yeah, exactly.
I don't think they were willing to foot the bill for something like that.
They canceled it for a reason.
It's like it was just going to get more expensive. But the to me, Milius is a brilliant rewriter.
Yeah,
he came up with a lot of the memorable dialogue, Dirty Harry, the great speech that Robert Shaw gives in Jaws. Mm-hmm. he has a gift for the rewriting, but the original scripts of the directing, it's some pacing issues there that they, of course, the documentary is not going to discuss his negatives or what I perceive as his negatives.
Right.
But I think that's one of the reasons he's just not a big name anymore. It's just like his stuff didn't make money. And I hate to shatter the conservative paranoia about Hollywood
right.
with this, but the fact is his movies just didn't make money. Conan didn't even make money.
No.
If they don't make money, he's just not going to have a lot of opportunities. It's like he's actually, he's done pretty well for himself.
No, and you know, being a rewriter's, that's a lucrative job in Hollywood.
Yeah. Well, it's like, another thing is, like, Spielberg breaks down saying that, because, you know, he has a stroke. He suffers from a stroke.
Which I thought was, that was kind of tough to watch, because I didn't even know that
it was,
happened.
But then Spielberg says that's the worst thing that's ever happened to anybody he knows or any of his friends. Which, I was like, wow, you really don't live much of a life, do you?
I think he was being kind of, I think he was waxing poetic there.
Well, apparently,
he was going, because this man who is a raconteur, who has the gift of speech, and now it is suddenly taken from him. It's, you know,
right.
It sounded like Spielberg was being
you didn't know anybody young, claimed by cancer, or died in a car accident. That would be far worse. Cause...
I mean, no, exactly. Well, and he even said that, this was worse than death. And I was like, oh, I think Spielberg was being a little dramatic there.
A little in Hollywood illusion land there. It's like, apparently he wasn't good friends with Vic Morrow and those two kids.
oh my gosh, yeah.
Yeah, worst thing that's ever happened to anybody. You know? Yeah, of course, because you apparently weren't friends with those victims of your film, you know, your film production.
Yeah, the irresponsible production.
Just insane. And but I mean, it's sad to see, but then you see him at the skeet shooting range.
Oh, and yeah, and he's got the shit-eating grin on his face, which was great.
The funny thing is he said the line, make my day, but that wasn't his line. He didn't write Sudden Impact.
So he didn't write that line?
I don't think he did.
Okay.
I might be wrong. Maybe there's something on Wikipedia. Because
they were acting like he was the saving grace for Dirty Harry, that like he's the responsible for how good that movie is.
No, I think the Harry Julian Fink and Rita Fink original script is the reason that Dirty Harry is so good. Well, and then Don Siegel directing and Eastwood's,
it's a lot of great creative talent coming together. You know, like, film's a collaborative process. You got Eastwood, you got Siegel, you got Milius, you got...
The editing, the Lalo Schifrin score, everything is perfect.
It's one of those movies where everybody's bringing their talents to the table, and it's magic.
Okay, according to IMDb, mm-hmm. Charles B. Pierce wrote the line, go ahead and make my day.
No way. Really?
Yeah, the line was inspired by a warning that his father would say to Pierce when he was a child. According to Pierce, his father warned him, when I come home tonight and the yard has not been mowed, you're going to make my day. So Milius that was not Milius' line. He didn't work on the other scripts. He just did Magnum Force and Dirty Harry.
No, yeah, that's right. Because I was getting confused. Yeah, that's not from Dirty Harry. Because I always forget that was from one of the sequels, not from the original, which had, Do I Feel Lucky? But as far as Magnum Force goes, are you a fan of that movie? Because I don't like that film very much.
I like it more than The Enforcer, and okay. I like it more than Sudden Impact and The Deadpool, but I still say that the first Dirty Harry movie feels like a completely different character.
Yeah.
It's like a different police officer named Dirty Harry, so I can't really relate the sequels to it.
Well, it's like, the Magnum Force to me felt like an apology almost, because in the first movie, Harry's this cop who sort of, you know, steps over the line sometimes, and it's controversial, but you're supposed to root for him because, you know, he's thinking of the victims, man. He's not thinking of the, you know, he doesn't care about the rights of the accused, you know. So, whereas in Magnum Force, Harry's got to find these cops that are killing Pete, that are doing what he was doing in the first movie.
Right, right.
You know? And it, to me, it felt like an apology to the critics, like Pauline Kael
who
had
who
was
Pauline
really
Kael
upset
actually,
over it.
Pauline Kael acclaimed Magnum Force. She loved it.
Oh, it was the apology. And it's directed by Don Post, who's flat.
Ted Post. Who also directed Good Guys Wear Black.
Don Post was the guy who made Masks.
He made the Bugglemeyer's mask.
No, yeah, you're right. Ted Post.
Which is funny because the point of view shots of Myers in Halloween was inspired by scenes in The Enforcer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, where the weird terrorist is like walking up behind a delivery man and stabs him in the back.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Ted Post. He also did Good Guys Wear Black with
Good Guys Wear Black, and he also did Go Tell the Spartans with Burt Lancaster, which is a Vietnam movie that's poorly directed but has a great Burt Lancaster performance.
Yeah, just Ted Post, like, between that and Good Guys Wear Black, I'm like, these both of these movies just are flat and uninteresting to
me. Well, he did Hang 'Em High with Eastwood, which is Eastwood's visually flattest movie of the 60s.
Well, I never saw that one.
Yeah, Hang 'Em High. I think which it's okay. It. Interesting Dominic Frontier music.
Every time I see the cover of Hang 'Em High, I want to put it next to the cover of the Jack Nicholson movie Going South.
But yeah, Magnum Force, I haven't watched it in years. I just remember it being super long.
Yeah, well, that's why I couldn't get through it, because it's so long, and it's just like, oh.
It is a funny scene that I do love, where he tricks the last of the motorcycle cops to ride off into the ocean. Mm-hmm. Just in the dockside duel, and he goes, yeah, he was right. You boys don't have enough experience, or something.
But Milius also kind of helped get Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale's career started.
Yeah.
With 1941 and I Want to Hold Your Hands.
I remember when 1941 came out, nobody wanted to go see it.
Have you ever seen that movie?
I tried watching it a few times.
It's 3 hours long.
As I said, I tried watching
it. It's not, no comedy, like, now every comedy is like 3 hours long, but geez, it's so long. It has some funny stuff, like the Slim Pickens and the Japanese spies as Christmas trees was, mm-hmm. That's, you know, one of the funniest things I've ever seen in a movie, but that's one scene in a sea of, like, just randomness. But he also produced, did you ever see Paul Schrader's Searchers remake Hardcore?
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
I watched that about a year ago or 2 years ago.
Yeah, that's a crazy movie.
It's pretty insane, and it's pretty wacky. It's certainly worth watching once.
Yeah,
the performances in it are really good.
And the scene of George C. Scott watching the snuff film and crying in the theater provided endless meme fodder for the internet in years
ago. Of course. Which, of course, people forget, at the time, you only went to a George C. Scott movie to see him act. You didn't care if the movie was any good. No, seriously, like, he was that well-loved as an actor that you, like, stuff like Islands in the Streams or, I think I was trying to watch something just this morning on Warner Archives called The Last Run or something where he's a hitman, and they're not really good movies. It's just, like, his acting is the only reason to sit through them.
He started the only Exorcist sequel that was worth a damn.
Well, he's the only reason to tolerate Firestarter.
That's true.
Like, he's the Indian assassin, and he's like, I give a girl a karate chop to the nose. And it's like just this great, grouchy George C. Scott performance that doesn't belong in the film.
Apparently, he was not happy with Paul Schrader on that movie.
Probably not.
And he went into his trailer and would not come out unless Paul Schrader promised never to direct again.
George C. Scott was a character. He was it's kind of forgotten that he was a name. Like, you could put his name on a movie and people went to see it.
Well, he's stars in one of the funniest movies ever, Doctor Strangelove. Oh my god.
Yeah, it's a terrific film. And there's no bad George C. Scott performance, but there's a lot of bad movies that he made.
Indeed.
But he was just one of those actors that you just put his name on a movie and had instant respect from your dads would go see it if you're my age.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even in your 40s, and they would go see that because of Patton, mainly.
Oh, yeah. Patton was my first exposure to him, being a history buff as a kid. And that was, you know, the perfect introduction to George C. Scott.
Right. And to me, Patton is almost like the most John Milius movie that John Milius never made.
Yeah, you're right. Although Coppola did work on the script for that.
Right. He did. And but, you know, to me, that's what every John Milius movie should have been, mm-hmm. but really wasn't. Like, that's my thing, is like, this guy just never really made a hit.
Yeah.
It's like, he kind of, and like I said, there were pacing issues with his films. Mm-hmm. There was such a thing as shooting your wad too soon and having the biggest action scene in the beginning.
Yeah.
That's like a crime that you never saw in Hong Kong movies in the 80s. I always say that was the golden age of action cinema, was the cheapest Hong Kong films of the 80s would have the best action scenes in the finale.
Oh, that's a syndrome of Japanese action movies that I've seen. Like,
well, yeah, because their pacing and structure is completely Eastern.
Oh, my gosh. You'd see, like, Takashi Miike films and stuff where you'd open with this insane, crazy action sequence, and then the rest of the movie is...
An hour of dialogue.
Yeah.
And, oh, there was, like, a Sonny Chiba Toei production called Ninja Wars, which starts off really cool, and then
that movie sounds awesome.
Nothing comes close to any of that. There's no action for the rest of the film.
I saw so many Japanese movies in college where it started off and I was like, this is the greatest movie I've ever seen.
And then it goes to hell.
And then, oh, we're just going to sit in a hotel room with some gangsters in a kiddie pool.
That's all they
and
do.
And it's really artsy and sensitive and weird.
Well, even the movie Violent Cop, I think Beat Takashi is a bit overrated, and I don't think his movies hold up very well when I try to look at him now. But we were crazy about him in the early 90s.
Oh,
in Violent Cop, the best scene is like in the first 10 minutes, where some young punk tries to get away with some mugging or beating or something. Miike just knocks on his door because he's a cop. They let him in the talk show, but he just starts beating him up. There's nothing else in the movie that's that cool.
Whenever Beat Takashi is in a movie, he's best when he's slapping somebody.
Yeah.
Or just beating the fuck out of somebody. Like, well, he just excels at that.
Unfortunately, most of his movies now, it's like there'll be a shootout in the beginning that's really shocking. Then he sits in a hotel room and drinks orange juice for an hour.
So it's like Sonatine or Fireworks or something.
Yeah, and I those movies just do not hold up at all for me. It's just
I haven't seen his recent ones, Outrage and Beyond Outrage.
I just watch Outrage is okay. That's the same shit. He's just playing a badass Yakuza. Okay. You've done this in every other movie. You're playing the same character.
Did you see the one with Omar Epps? Aniki!
Yeah, brother. I saw that in the theater, and then I got the uncut Hong Kong DVD that had, like, tons of blood.
Really?
I mean, the Japanese DVD was too expensive, so I got it from Hong Kong, same print. Way gorier than what was released in American
theaters. I don't remember it being gory at all. I saw
the American version. It's super gory if you watch the... If you get a Hong Kong or Japanese DVD, the print is way bloodier and gorier than what you saw in the theater.
That is interesting.
Or what's on American home video. Like, it was super cut up. And it's funny because I think Garo spotted that because I think he watched an import DVD before he saw it in the theater. And then he wrote to Ain't It Cool News and said that Sony had cut up the film. He broke the story. But I forget what code name he used or pseudonym he used for
which probably prompted Harry to write a post about how it's not worth pissing on or something.
He probably called himself Cartman or something when he ratted the Ain't It Cool News that Sony's cut this film up and censored it or whatever, and it was all, you know, like suddenly it was out that they'd cut it domestically, but nobody cared enough about Takashi's movies to make a huge fuss about it.
Getting back to Milius real quick, one more movie I want to know what you think of. What's we only mentioned it briefly, Jeremiah Johnson.
I haven't watched it in like 15 years, and after I saw this documentary, I wanted to go back and rewatch it.
You know, I watched it the other day because that was one I hadn't seen, so I was like, I need to brush up and see something, that one of the major ones I hadn't seen. I watched it, and I had problems with it, but I really liked it.
Yeah, it's a big favorite. It's one of my mom's favorite movies.
I loved the way it made me feel afterwards. Like, I don't know, there was just, it left me with a certain feeling that I really liked. And, you know, I did have some issues with it. I'm not a Robert Redford fan at all.
Yeah, me neither.
Not really a Paul Newman fan either, but I like Judge Roy Bean for some reason.
Newman's hit or miss with me, to make it clear.
Yeah. I like him a lot more than Redford, I should say.
I love Slapshot. I don't like Harper. I think Harper is actually a bad movie with a bad Paul Newman performance. And nobody else agrees with me on that. I don't care for The Drowning Pool. So he's made a lot of stuff that I don't even... like Fort Apache, The Bronx.
You know what movie I could never get through?
What's that?
I'm going to get rocks thrown at me is Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
I don't think it's that good.
I just... Every time I watch it, I'm just like, yeah, I'd rather watch a different Western. Like, I just...
Yeah, a real Western.
Strikes me as phony, you know.
I think it's hugely overrated.
I can never get to that legendary final shootout, but but I really like Jeremiah Johnson. It does have some stuff in it that hasn't aged well, like some of the songs in it. Mm-hmm. Some say you never die. Some say you never will.
I kind of remember that. Johnson. I think that inspired Pacific International Enterprises to release Frontier movies.
Really?
I suspect it did. I mean, I don't know for sure. You'd have to talk to the guy who actually ran that company mm-hmm. to know. But I feel like Jeremiah Johnson inspired them to start making the wilderness adventure films.
It also had some dumb shit, like when he's learning to
so uncouth, sir.
He's learning to hunt elk from this mountain man who's teaching him mm-hmm. the ways of the mountain, and the guy's yelling at him as to how to change his form and, you know, don't do it like that. And he's screaming at him. And I'm like, that elk would be long gone. Like, there's no way that elk's sticking around if you're yelling
at
that
elk. Dude, they can hear a twig break a mile away.
I mean, I've been hunting.
I've been hunting too, and they hear shit. You could step on a feather, and deer a mile away will run.
Deer just go, nope, getting.
They've got, like, super hearing.
Yeah,
like,
they do.
Like the $6 million man.
Yeah, they know when something is amiss in the wilderness.
You breathe, and it's like, and they're running.
I mean, so like, with the initial hunting scene, I was like, get the fuck out of here.
It's like Chimino's the deer hunter where they're jumping into the pit and stabbing the deer Conan style.
Chimino's the deer hunter is like, that is a movie that's made by somebody who's never been deer hunting.
Nah, I don't think Chimino had ever held a gun in his life. Oh. He's one of those guys. They apparently lied about being in Vietnam and lied about being in the army and like had a completely phony biography.
Well, and he was one of those Ayn Rand types, you know.
Yeah, he's a strange character, very strange.
But
he likes Mickey Rourke, so we excuse a lot.
Yes, we do. Year of the Dragon, but exactly. I am a Heaven's Gate fan, though, I will admit. Criterion's
I like Year of the Dragon. It sucks, but I love it.
Year of the Dragon's fucking dope.
It's hilarious. He's got, like, his gray hair, but his face is, like, he's, like, 30. Mm-hmm. He's got white hair, like, he's this old expert. I'm like, it's Mickey Rourke with a baby face. He's, like, 30 years old.
But as far as Jeremiah Johnson goes, you know, Sidney Pollack, I don't think much of a director either, but...
No, he's not. He's a hack.
Everything I've ever seen by him just... Yeah. Did you ever see The Yakuza?
You know, I haven't seen it in years. I bought a DVD at Big Lots about a month ago and still haven't watched it.
I just tried watching it once.
It's very slow.
I thought I'd like it because it was Paul Schrader and blah, blah, blah. But
if you watch real Yakuza movies, it's not very good.
Well, that's the thing is I'd seen movies like Battles Without Honor and Humanity and stuff.
They're keeping a lot of there's no interest of that stuff in our market, so we don't have a lot of the really good Yakuza movies on American home video. That's like the most neglected genre of all time.
You want to hear one of the saddest stories ever? So,
do I?
Yeah. I went to, this was back when Borders was still around.
Uh-huh.
I was at Borders and they had the Yakuza Papers box set there.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, oh shit, it's the Yakuza Papers box set. I gotta grab this. And I went up, I bought it. I went out to my car. I had a funny feeling. Sometimes I get like this stinky feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I go, I'm gonna check this real quick. And I opened it up.
Deucing sense was tingling.
My DVD collector's sense was going off. And I opened it up. All the discs were gone.
Whoa!
It was empty.
Whoa.
I must have been like when a cop picks up a gun and he notices a few rounds are missing. You
know? Yeah. Oh.
That was like heartbreak.
Oh, no.
I was so excited to go home and watch, you know, Battles Without Honor Humanity and all the sequels and nope. I think there was one disc in there. There was one.
The hell did that happen?
I don't know. That is one of the weirdest because it was sealed and everything.
Oh, I bought the sequels. All of the sequels from Amazon dealers were about from like $1.50 to $3.
Yeah, I mean,
and I bought all because they've been remaindered. I've even seen them at Dollar General stores, not for a dollar, but like $5 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the first film is not available for that price.
I think I still have a copy of the first one because I
yeah, and I'm eventually going to get the first film, but I'm just not in a hurry because I don't love those as much as some of the other Yakuza movies that I've been seeing through bootlegs and such. That I think are more interesting. The ones with like Ken Takakura basically goes to a town. He's out of jail. A gang is controlling the area. Their small village, and at the end, Ken Takakura kills everybody. And apparently there was like 100 movies like that, but you never get tired of it.
Well, it's like Shaw Brothers movies, you know. Oh, the master's dead, I must avenge him, you know.
It's not a tiresome formula, you know.
No, it's not. I mean,
you know.
There are infinite numbers of ways that you can show someone kicking someone's ass, you know.
Right, you know? Exactly. And there's different ways. You're playing the same tune, but you do it a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're almost playing a different tune. And that's what, like, with the blues. You cover the same blues songs. Yeah. There's different ways of doing them. And sometimes you get, like, a Hendrix version. Sometimes you get the Yardbirds version. So there's different ways of doing it.
Yep. So final thoughts on Milius, the documentary as a whole. What do you reckon?
It's a good documentary. It's worth watching. It'll have you, whatever Milius films you haven't seen, you will want to go back and see them, even though I don't recommend a ton of his films, but I like some of them a lot. Particularly his early stuff like Dillinger and The Wind and the Lion. And there's no doubt the guy is one of the best script doctors of all time, if not the best.
And
I mean, I can make the argument he's the best script doctor of all time because of Jaws and Dirty Harry.
I haven't seen Big Wednesday, but like my favorite Milius movies are Dillinger, Wind and the Lion. Actually, well, I like Wind and the Lion more, but Wind and the Lion, Dillinger, and Rough Riders.
Yeah,
check that out.
I'm gonna buy Rough Riders. It's only like $5 on Amazon.
Yeah, check it out. I mean, it's been a few years since I've seen it, but I remember loving it and thinking that.
Yeah, I would probably enjoy it. I think his mode, I think, works better for westerns than trying to make like a Robert Howard fantasy, which he turned into a Mongol movie.
Right. I think he's better when he's doing a frontiersman movie, like just any western, anything where it's the. I love Judge Roy Bean.
I think he strikes me as when he was a kid, he read all the Land books, which was a Random House's line of history books for young boys.
Mm-hmm.
It was like for 10-year-old boys. Like there was a whole series of these, and they ran, I think, till the 60s. And I may have brought these up before, but they were big favorite reading of kids in the 50s.
I see.
It'd be like, one was about Teddy Roosevelt, one was about Wild Bill Hickok, and I collect them. Actually, anytime I'm at a thrift store or I see a stack of them at a library sale and I've got in-laws looking for them, and an aunt in-law gave me a huge box of them. She'd found it at a garage sale.
I remember we had something similar when I was a kid. I had one on Robert E. Lee and...
That's what they did. Like, I could just look at my shelf right now, and it's Custer's Last Stand, The Copper Kings, The Alaska Gold Rush... Balboa, Alexander the Great. It's just, it's endless. It's like Sequoia, Legend of the Leader of the Cherokees, Texas Rangers. Yeah. It's like a the Hudson Bay Company. You know, that's exciting.
Was it the Texas Rangers? They talked about he had written like a Texas Rangers movie
for Eastwood.
Like Eastwood, yeah.
Which is, I heard that was actually a really good unproduced script. Pirate Lafitte in the Battle of New Orleans, Daniel Boone. It's basically like a 1950s Captain Cook explores the South Seas, which I think is actually an Alistair MacLean book modified for juveniles. But it was just like, it made history exciting, and I think that's what he grew up reading. And of course, he was seeing John Ford movies and Howard Hawks movies in the theater. That's the mentality he came up with, and which is men back when men were men and were real heroes or whatever. So, the funny thing is when the John Woo movies were really big in the early 90s, I kind of wondered if maybe that's what they always thought Milius was going to make. Some hyper violent movie about brotherhood with a high body count.
With
or
the, like
loyalty.
Kind of like a Shaw Brothers movie, like a Cheng Che one, you know?
Right. And of course, I remember reading an article in Film Comment that. When they showed a King Hu film at USC, nobody really responded to it except like Oliver Stone, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
Stone? Huh.
Yeah, Stone is a huge fan of Hong Kong movies.
Interesting.
And he's dated some of the actresses. I'm not naming names.
I know he's got a little Asian fetish going there, I think.
Yeah, but he's a huge fan of those movies. Because I used to know this dickhead in Hollywood, S. Dacey, who was basically bootlegging Hong Kong movies he was renting at a grocery store, copying them and selling them to Oliver Stone. And he would boast of having dinners at Oliver Stone's Malibu home and telling him what new Hong Kong films Stone had to see. And I know that Stone was originally tried to make a deal for John Woo in America. They were going to produce something for one of the Ree brothers from Best of the Best. It was going to be called Kato. But it was about like a hitman who gets wounded and then he's saved by monks and they bring him back to health and he goes on a shooting rampage for revenge. And I think it was one of the might have been Philip Ree or one of them.
Sounds like a Shaw Brothers script. Yeah.
Right, right. It was basically very probably better than what we ended up getting from John Woo in this country.
Oh yeah.
But I often felt like some people had said that Millis was inspired by the Lone Wolf and Cub. You could see some of that in Conan probably with the blood usage. And I never really felt like his movies, like when you saw the praise about John Woo, that's what they expected from a Milius film.
Right.
Yeah. Like I always thought maybe Conan the Barbarian would have been better if it had been made in Hong Kong by the Shaw Brothers or Golden Harvest after seeing something like Zoo, Warriors of the Magic Mountain and some of the sword and sorcery films Shaw Brothers made is more impressive than Conan.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you get more of a Howard vibe from some of those, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Certainly visually, they look like the comic books brought to life.
I still can't get over how awesome 8 Diagram Pole Fighter looks.
I know. And movie. People will act like, oh, you hate superhero films. No, it's just that I feel like that Marvel Comics flavor was captured better in the Shaw Brothers movies of the 70s than by what's called a Marvel movie today.
And, you know, Amazing Spider-Man 2 is making money hand over fist, but...
But it had a 73% drop this week.
Nobody likes it. Nobody who I know who's seen it has said it's good. Everybody's disappointed with it. And yet they go to see it. And they'll go to see the third one when it comes out opening.
I know a few people who actually...
Who what?
Yeah, they'll keep going and going. I do know somebody who loved the new Spider-Man movie.
Oh, goodness. Wait. Okay.
Yeah, he's actually saying it's one of the best superhero films ever.
Oh, okay. Well... to each
but it's nobody, nobody who's been it's nobody who's been in the podcast world yet. So.
Okay. Oh yes.
Maybe we'll change that, but we're not going to talk about Spider-Man if we get him on.
Yeah, we'll talk about kung fu movies.
Exactly. So, yeah. but no, he's willing to defend it, and he makes some interesting points when he defends it against people who didn't like it. So,
all right.
And I have some people say that it's captured the Spider-Man vibe actually better than the Raimi movies because I guess he's more of a smart aleck and
I think the quippiness of Spider-Man is better in those movies for sure.
Yeah,
but I like the look of the Raimi ones better. I'm you know, they remind me more of the Jack Kirby stuff, you know,
or Steve Ditko.
That's what I meant. Sorry,
right? Because he's a Ditko Romita fan. I think Raimi was. And it looks like these new ones are made more of the Spider-Mans I've never read.
Like it's more like the ultimate, you know, Spider-Man type stuff.
All I've read is up to like the 70s of the Spectacular Spider-Man was like the Disco Destroyer or whatever the hell the villain's name.
Well, when I was growing up in the 90s, that was the dark ages for Spider-Man when they had like Spider-Man's been cloned.
Yeah, like Bell Bottoms. You're right. Him being in college and the whole Spider-Man vibe is what I know better.
Yeah,
I don't know about the Sinister Six. People were talking about that. I never read the Black Cat. I don't know what she is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she's...
But I've never read any of that Spider-Man
stuff. She's
but...
a Catwoman knockoff is what she is.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's what
like
it sounds like.
She and Spider-Man have, like, a weird romantic thing that, like, Batman and Catwoman have, you know?
Ah, okay. But, of course, because Marvel was not a ripoff, right?
No, of course not. It's totally original.
Even though they'll take... Guys like Marv Wolfman and Gary Conway will take the same ideas. Was a DC and just put them in the whatever book they've been assigned.
Yes. Well, I can hear my connection, breaking up. So I think we're going to have to call this one a day. The spirit of Milius lives on. Hopefully, one day we'll get that Genghis Khan movie, and maybe it'll be better than the Mongol. We'll see.
Well, it was offered to the RZA 2 years ago, but luckily, man, with Aaron Fistbaum.
Oh fuck! Yeah. Oh please, God. No. Oh jeez. Oh. That's the worst movie I saw that year by far.
Yeah, oof. Bad.
Anyway, with that said, what would a Conan-esque sign off be?
Jeez. If it was a Howard sign off, it would be pretty poetic.
Yes, it would be.
If it was a Milius Howard sign off or Bilious Conan and be like, "Bah."
So, yeah, that's gonna be my sign up for today. Bah!
My sign off would be conquer your own kingdoms.
Yeah, yeah, and see the women driven before you, and or no, your enemies, and hear the lamentations of the women. Right,
crush your enemies, hear the lamentations of the women.
That is good.
Take the property. Stop the global warming. No.
Back when I was running for governor, though, I would tell you I'd drive my Hummer through your arguments about global warming.
Because his competitor was Arianna Huffington.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
That crazy Greek.
And a porn star. Gee, wonder how he won.
Yeah. Mary Carey. Oof. All right. That's it for this evening.
Conquer your own kingdoms.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.